You're listening to the Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, immigration policy has seen big changes in the last few years, and our guest looks past the daily headlines to the big picture. We'll meet the author of the book Banned, Immigration Enforcement in the Time of Trump. Now, the White House announced last week that the 2020 International Group of Seven Summit would be held at President Trump's golf resort in Doral, Florida. The backlash to that announcement was swift. Criticism came not just from President Trump's political opponents, but from some of his allies as well. Central to the controversy was the fact that the president and his family could profit off of the multi-nation meeting. This created the appearance of conflicts of interest, but potentially violated a clause in the Constitution. Since then, the president has abandoned that plan and blasted his critics, saying, quote, "You people with this phony emoluments clause," end quote. Our next guest joins us to talk about the emoluments clause and how it's factored into the presidency. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. Her books include Women in the White House and Mad Men and Politics. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today.
What was your reaction when it was first announced that Trump's resort would host this international summit?
Well, I guess I was a little bit surprised because there's been so much approach and to some degree pushback on some of the sort of not requirements, but encouragement of various foreign entities to stay in the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. And then there's been some controversies about like Mike Pence's trip to Ireland and him staying at another Trump property while there. And there are a number of lawsuits that are going on around this. And so to have the president basically sort of say, well, we're going to have the G7 meeting at one of my hotels seems a lot.
I want to give a listen to President Trump talking today at what was billed as a cabinet meeting. The press was there. It went on for about 70 minutes. Here's some of what he had to say related to the emoluments issue.
Other presidents, if you look, other presidents were wealthy. Not huge wealth. George Washington was actually considered a very, very rich man at the time. But they ran their businesses. George Washington, they say, had two desks. He had a presidential desk and a business desk. I don't think you people with this phony emoluments clause, and by the way, I would say that it's cost me anywhere from $2 to $5 billion to be president. And that's okay between what I lose and what I could have made. I would have made a fortune if I just ran my business. I was doing it really well. I have a great business. I have the best properties.
Let's focus in on the part that a lot of people have quoted there, the you people with this phony emoluments clause, Lily.
Yeah, well, Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution and Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, they're both there. I don't think they're phony. I read them every semester with my students in my Intro to American Politics class. And Article 1, Section 9 in particular is part of a section of the Constitution where things are prohibited, either specifically to Congress or to sort of the federal government in general. So, you know, there can't be any titles of royalty given out. But there is a significant prohibition in Article 1, Section 9 with regard to any public officer. And so Trump would be, because he's president of the United States, a public officer. And no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. So that's kind of where we are with Article 1, Section 9.
Right. And that's people raise concerns. OK, if a diplomatic delegation decides to stay at a Trump resort or hotel, as you mentioned, or the president of Ukraine mentions in a phone call, according to the partial transcript released by the White House, that he had stayed in a Trump resort. That's the kind of thing that might raise concern under that.
Yeah. I mean, there is this, you know, sort of indirectness with regard to, say, coming and staying, if you are the Saudi delegation, as they have done, coming to Washington, D.C., staying in a Trump property and doing business with the United States, specifically with the Trump administration. But that's an indirect sort of situation. But having the president basically say, we're going to have this G7 conference where all of these people are going to be coming from all of these countries, as well as all the press that goes along with it, and all of the support teams that go along with it, and all the security that goes along with it, and it's going to be at my property. That seems like it may be in violation of that prohibition in Article 1, Section 9.
Have we seen anything comparable to this before? President Trump mentioned George Washington. I've seen some historians say a little different case, but are we in an unprecedented territory here?
Well, you know, we've had other, obviously, we've had other presidents over the years who have had wealth and they've had business interests. Famously, Jimmy Carter had to put his peanut farm into a trust. George W. Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush put all of their businesses into what are called blind trusts so that they are completely separated from them. President Trump, when he came into office, sort of put his interest into a trust, but the trust is being run by his sons. So it's not necessarily as disconnected as I understand it, and I am not an accountant in this regard. It's not as disconnected as putting all of your businesses into a kind of a blind trust and having it completely separated from the decisions that you're making.
And the president referred to my business. I have a great business. I have the best properties. That suggests a lack of distance?
They're also still his and they have his name on it. And that was also one of the discussions, even if he said that the Miami property was going to be providing all of the capacity for the G7 meeting at cost, there's still sort of all of these potential ways of making money over advertising and you know, sort of media focus, which, again, is not something that's necessarily quantifiable in the cost of a room per night.
Who enforces the emoluments clause when it pertains to the president of the United States?
Well, this, again, comes down to Congress and Congress's oversight. And there was starting to be a move in Congress before the president basically said we're not going to have it there, that they were going to come in and potentially vote to prohibit this kind of a situation. And this may also contribute to more of the articles of impeachment in terms of violations of the emoluments clause. And we have a second, as I said, there are two places where emoluments are mentioned in the Constitution. And the other places in Section 2, which is specific, or Article 2, which is specifically about the president. And it says that the president shall not receive within the period that he is elected any other emoluments from the United States, being the government itself, or from any of the states. So if the United States is renting rooms in the Doral, then that may also be a violation of the Article 2 prohibition.
In our last few moments, Lily, what are you watching for next on the emoluments issue?
Well, again, it's up to Congress on whether or not they're going to go any further with this if they are pursuing it. And there are quite a few lawsuits going on at this point by various entities, including like the state of Maryland, that are moving with regard to suggesting that there have been violations thus far with regard to the emoluments clause.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's my pleasure to be here.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. Her books include Women in the White House and Mad Men and Politics. She joined us for a look at the Emoluments Clause in light of President Trump's recent decision to host an International Group of Seven summit at his resort in Florida. He since backed off from that plan. Coming up, we'll learn about a program that brings free basic medical care to uninsured farm workers in the Dodgeville area. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a doctor providing medical care for free on farms in southwestern Wisconsin. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum answering a Why Wisconsin question about an iconic state symbol.
We recently received a question from a listener named Patty. She asked, why are people into wearing cheese heads? I mean, we all have our personal reasons for plopping giant triangles of yellow foam on our heads or wearing wedge earrings to every single Wisconsin sporting event, from football to baseball, college to the pros. But let's go back to the beginning, to one of the first times a person cut up a piece of foam, declared it cheese, and wore it on their head. It all started with taunts from Chicago sports fans in the 1980s.
Our lovely neighbors to the south from Illinois have been affectionately calling us Wisconsinites cheeseheads for quite a period of time, and even though they love to spend their time and money up here, which is great, you know, they call us cheeseheads.
That's Ralph Bruno.
Which didn't offend me because personally, I love cheese.
And throughout the 80s, Wisconsin dominated U.S. cheese production, churning out more than 1.5 billion pounds of cheese each year. Bruno decided he wanted to own that cheesehead insult. So while reupholstering his mom's couch in 1987, he cut out a triangle chunk of foam, burned holes into it, and painted it. He threw the hat into a bag and went off to County Stadium to tailgate with his friends before a Brewers game.
And my buddies, we were having our Pabst Blue Ribbons, and when it came time to go into the for the game, I pulled it out and put it on my head, and people started calling me a cheesehead and pointing at me.
Bruno says it shocked his friends because he considered himself a shy guy. But then
a girl came running up to me and wanted to try it on, and my buddies were watching how girls were running up to me for the first time ever. And so they were then took the hat, and we had fun playing with it throughout the game. So
2 weeks later, Bruno founded the company Foamation.
Over in this area is our, we call the main production area.
Today, Foamation employees produce everything from foam cheese bow ties to Christmas tree toppers, all in the Walker's Point neighborhood in Milwaukee. On this particular morning, one worker trims the edges off foam cheese baseball hats. CJ Williams is about to make a classic cheesehead hat. He preps the wedge-shaped mold.
So I put the wax around the little edges and stuff so it doesn't stick to it all the way. It doesn't make it rip a lot, you know.
Then he fills a cup with a bright yellow liquid.
This is the product that goes into it. This is the coloring. This is what makes the money.
Williams blends the liquid, then quickly pours it into the mold. It starts to foam and harden fast. After a bit, Williams proudly unveils a fresh cheese head.
It's actually pretty cool because, like, how many people can actually say, like, oh, I work where they make the cheese heads? And people will be like, nah, they're made up in Green Bay, but they're really made here. I live in Wisconsin, you know, I always support the cheese, you know what I'm saying?
As much as Williams loves making cheese heads, people are just as proud to wear them. Cheesehead pride really hit its stride about 20 years ago. While some of the first cheesehead sightings were at County Stadium, they eventually made the leap to Lambeau Field. Again, Ralph Bruno.
In the mid-90s, when good old Brett Favre came into town, it kind of exploded on the scene there up in Lambeau. And that year, we couldn't make enough of them. We expanded our production like 600%.
And since then, Bruno has helped Wisconsinites take ownership of the word cheesehead.
It's like a badge of honor. It's really more about the essence of who we are. You don't have to be born here. It's grown outside of just about the cheese and more about the mindset of the Midwestern mentality, the openness that we have, the outgoingness that we have, not just, you know, somebody wearing a hat. It's kind of a cultural thing, I guess.
This story about cheeseheads came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a new program in the Dodgeville area brings volunteer doctors to farm fields to provide free medical care to farm workers, many of whom are uninsured and can't access regular care. Dr. Emily Jewell works with the Community Connections Free Clinic Program and their new Free Clinic on Wheels, or FCOW. Dr. Jewell, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how did you get involved in FCOW, the Free Clinic on Wheels?
Thanks. That's a great question. You know, I have been involved with something called the Community Clinic out in Dodgeville. That is a clinic that was put together by the community and funded by the community. And together with those folks, we kind of talked about going out to the farms and servicing population that we hadn't had a chance to see as much in the clinic as what we wanted. You know, we would get people there, but we knew that we were missing a section of the population. And I personally have an interest in helping out folks, both farmers and farm workers. And so that's kind of where the idea sprung from.
I understand you have roots in the area.
I do. So I grew up between Dodgeville and Mineral Point on a hog farm. And yeah, I'm back here now.
talk about the workers you're reaching out to. What kind of health access do they have or not have? Who are we talking about here?
Great question. So, you know, a large percentage of the workers on farms in Wisconsin, dairy farms and some of the larger farms, are Hispanic immigrant workers. A certain percentage of those would be undocumented folks. And so their access to health care is less than what maybe a natural-born citizen's access to health care would be like.
And even if they have documentation to work, they may not have health insurance, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think there's a number of folks who don't have access to health care just because it is cost prohibitive. And so, yeah, that's just it. You know, the Community Connections Free Clinic in Dodgeville, their mission is to serve folks who are uninsured and underinsured. And so this was a way to kind of take that mission and take it to the local community who has helped to fund that clinic and that mission, and help take care of some of the workers who are working the hours that clinic is open and who wouldn't be able to have an opportunity for health care otherwise.
What kind of injuries, illnesses are you often working with people on the farms on?
Great question. So our mission when we go to the farms is to provide screening exams, kind of like when you go to your doctor for your physical every year. So a lot of what we were hoping to intervene on and what we're finding is chronic illnesses. So folks who have high blood pressure, who have diabetes, but maybe don't know or maybe don't have the opportunity to care for that. So we've found quite a bit of those kind of things. You know, farm workers are working a very physical job, and so we see a lot of musculoskeletal, repetitive work. I wouldn't, you know, you could call it injuries or you could just call it what happens when you do the same kind of things over and over and over. And so, you know, talking with folks about the ergonomics of lifting and helping them make sure that they are treating their bodies in a way that will give them longevity in their job. So really our mission there is to try to intervene before somebody's been a diabetic for 20 years or been hypertensive for 20 years and has downstream effects of that, or, you know, worked doing heavy lifting for 20 years and has a back that no longer supports what they need to do to keep their livelihood. So what we really want to do is help people stay healthy.
Talking to Dr. Emily Jewell about the Free Clinic on Wheels program in southwestern Wisconsin. Dr. Jewell, let's talk about the wheels now. What's it like setting up and working in a clinic that you can drive around?
Yeah, it's really cool. It's really cool. And I'll tell you that we, you know, the Dodgeville community and the surrounding area has really been so supportive. We're driving around in an old bus that was donated from Head Start from Southwest CAP, which is an organization that functions in the southwest portion of the state to help folks who are struggling either financially or socially. And we took this bus and had it painted, and the nurse who is the main nurse at the clinic, her husband is a welder, and so he kind of outfitted the inside of it. We've got it going now so that when we go out to the farms, if there's not a place to have an exam area at the farm, like an office space, then we're able to bring people on the bus and do their exams there. It's just been really, really cool.
This is primary care for the most part. If you work with a farm worker who needs something more involved or specialist care or something like that, is there an option? Do you have access to that?
Yeah. So that gets a little bit more complicated. We try to do as much as we can ourselves. We have a partner in Upland Hills Health. That's the hospital in Dodgeville, which is a critical access hospital. So they'll help us run labs. They'll do basic things like x-ray. But if we need anything more complicated than that, then we have to apply for a program called community care, which is basically the hospital's charity care. There is a program run out of Madison for specialist care. It's a group of mostly retired physicians, but some of them are still in practice, and So we can have access to that specialty care, but it is somewhat limited to just a quota of visits per month. So luckily, you know, family physicians, I am one of those, and most of the folks who work at the free clinic are family physicians, but we actually do have kind of a wide array of folks there, from emergency room physicians and internal medicine physicians. But, you know, we have been taught quite a bit of the different basic specialty information to be able to troubleshoot a lot of stuff. And if we need extra care, it's available, but it is somewhat limited.
You're filling a gap here. If someone came to you and said, okay, we can help you out, we can help fill this gap more or in a different way, what would you say? What would be the way to provide better access to care out there?
Oh, that's a great question. I think one of the things is just getting the word out. We have been doing this program, you know, our pilot was in the fall of 2018, and farmers are really busy and their schedules don't stop and they milk 24/7. You know, the animals need attention and the people are always needing to work. And so if we could get the word out, get the word to resources out to the folks who are working, I think that is some of the bottleneck, is that everybody is busy and everybody's trying to make things work for what they know they have to get done. And sometimes people aren't aware of what services are available. And so some of what the bottleneck for us has been is getting the word out so that people know that our services are available and that we'd love to come out and screen their workers for health problems.
Dr. Jewell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Emily Jewell provides free medical care to farm workers through the Community Connections Free Clinic Program's Free Clinic on Wheels, or FCOW. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book looking at how immigration enforcement has changed nearly 3 years into the Trump presidency. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, the U.S. Supreme Court kicked off a new term this month, and future court appointments are a big issue in the 2020 elections. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at a new Wisconsin survey on what we think about the nation's highest court. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump is rounding out his third year in office, and one of the issues that's defined his presidency is immigration. We saw policies early on, like the ban on travel from a changing set of majority Muslim countries, often called the Muslim ban, then more recent policies like stricter asylum restrictions and family separation. In a new book, our next guest is untangling the complicated system immigrants are navigating and taking a big picture view of how much immigration enforcement has changed throughout the Trump administration. Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia is a professor of law at Penn State University and an expert in immigration law. She's the founder and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Her new book is called Banned: Immigration Enforcement in the Time of Trump. Shobha, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, we've talked a lot over the years, including with you, about kind of the day-to-day headlines in immigration. You step back some in the book and look at the big picture, and one of the big issues you look at is the idea of discretion in U.S. immigration enforcement. Why is that something we should focus on more?
So when I talk about the theme of discretion, I refer or define it as a choice that's being made by the government about how to enforce immigration law or treat people. And my synopsis to share one is that discretion has really informed many of the policy changes we've seen in the time of Trump. Or to put another way, it's not a legal mandate or requirement that's driving many immigration policy changes, but rather this extraordinary use of discretion by the administration.
And that might surprise a lot of people who think we have very hard and fast, very well-defined guidelines and rules. There's a lot of discretion both from the president's office to Congress down to an embassy or an immigration enforcement person, right?
Absolutely. So one goal I have in this book is to show both the micro uses of discretion, so the choice that ICE or Immigration Customs Enforcement might make on whether to arrest a person or place that same person in removal proceedings, as well as macro choices, like the choice from the White House to enact not one, but three different policies that restrict people from Muslim-majority countries from being in the United States.
And to set the stage here a little bit more, you go back before President Trump to the founding of the Department of Homeland Security. There was a big change in the bureaucracy of our various immigration enforcement agencies. Can you talk about what changed then?
Sure. So in the wake of September 11th, 2001, Congress deliberated over a new agency called the Department of Homeland Security. It was created legislatively and became effective long before the Trump administration in 2003. There are three main immigration functions: this enforcement arm I talked about earlier, ICE, a border arm, if you will, Customs Border Protection, and a services arm called Citizenship and Immigration Services. You know, one interesting observation made by a former INS head that I spoke to in the course of writing this book is how significant the enforcement outlook by services is, and how something like that would have never happened in a previous administration. She used the example of somebody going into a naturalization interview and said today somebody can go into a naturalization interview and come out in handcuffs. That would have never happened prior to DHS being created.
A big area of discretion kind of comes naturally, you write. There's a limited amount of resources when it comes to immigration enforcement, not enough to enforce it on everyone who might be in the country illegally. How has that changed the decision of who to enforce, who to make priorities, I guess, from the Obama administration to the Trump administration?
That's a great question, because if we were to put the who aside, who should we target for removal? The practical matter is that we have limited resources. The government has, according to one guideline in 2011, money to deport about 400,000 or less than 4% of the entire undocumented immigrant population. So in that way, the discretion of who to enforce the law against is inevitable because of these limited resources. This is where discretion becomes so important, because as an American, as a taxpayer, I want my government focusing their limited resources on the highest priorities, people who pose a true security threat, not parents who have children that go to the same school as my kids, who are worried about their future, who are taxpayers, and who are building their lives in the United States.
Talking to Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia about her new book, Banned: Immigration Enforcement in the Time of Trump. I think supporters of the president's immigration policies being applied kind of across the board is the message it sends to people in other countries. They're saying we don't want lots of people trying to cross the southern border in particular. If everybody in the world gets the message that we're going to enforce it across the board, maybe that's going to deter people from trying to cross into the country illegally, or as some people say it, to try to, what they would say, take advantage of our asylum system. What would you say to that? I think that's a fair summary of many of the president's supporters.
So the southern border has been a talking point by this president and his supporters since he took office. And the choice made by the administration to create more restrictions at the southern border are similarly significant. I can't say that I agree that it is a deterrent to have more restrictions in place, that it would stop people from coming if they are leaving dangerous situations. And I've met with and represented individuals and families who came through the southern border, are in the United States, maybe detained, maybe outside of detention, and oftentimes they're fleeing for their lives. And having an additional restriction isn't necessarily going to stop that flow.
Toward the end of your book, you look at a lot of different issues, but you give some recommendations on where changes can be made. And one place you're looking is to Congress in particular. And this is something that Congress has tried to do on and off over the years to clarify our immigration policy, to change it. What would you like to see come out of Congress in particular?
With Congress, you know, one solution is legislative, and to create a permanent pathway for people who have been in the United States, have built lives, and lived here for a lengthy period. That may include individuals who have or had a type of discretion called DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Any person who has DACA has lived in the United States for over a decade. That may include TPS, or temporary protected status holders, whose status has been vulnerable in the time of Trump, and in many cases have lived here for decades. And finally, people who are undocumented, living in the U.S., but contributing in meaningful ways. In my view, these are types of people who should be given the opportunity to be on a legal path to permanency.
You also devote a chapter to refugees. They've been in the news on and off in the Trump administration. Can you talk big picture about what has changed since early 2017?
Absolutely. And refugees, who we might call the most vulnerable, have really illustrate how discretion has been used in such a significant way. They are defined in the law as people who have suffered a type of harm called persecution, or who would face persecution in the future because of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. And I think it's important to share that definition to demystify any idea that every person who is a refugee or comes to the United States will ultimately qualify as a refugee. What is important, however, is that our laws say, Congress wrote the law, that any person is eligible to apply for protection. This is a humanitarian remedy in our law. And the administration has used its discretion to slash refugee numbers, so people outside the United States seeking admission, and to essentially shut down asylum at the southern border through a myriad of executive policies that include, for example, forcing certain asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while their cases are processed, or making people ineligible for asylum if they transited through another country before arriving in the United States. These are policies that are inhumane, and in many cases violate our statute.
We're talking to Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia from Penn State University about her new book, Banned: Immigration Enforcement in the Time of Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the changes you've seen in immigration since President Trump took office? Do you support a tougher stance on immigration? Do you think some of the president's policies have been good? Have some of them gone too far? What, if anything, would you like to see change? If you are an immigrant yourself, call in and tell us what your experience has been like. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about big picture changes in immigration enforcement under President Trump. Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia is with us, an expert in immigration law at Penn State Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the immigration changes we've seen under President Trump? Have you been affected by any of these changes we're talking about? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Shobha, President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals was done, I believe, as an executive order. A lot of President Trump's actions have been done as executive orders. You talked in your book to some immigration officials who say, gosh, we'd sure prefer these to be formal rulemaking things rather than these executive orders. Can you talk about the use of that particular policy tool?
Sure. The executive order is one tool in the executive toolbox. Once it is signed, it is legally binding. Importantly, no executive order is above the Constitution or the statute. And put another way, no president is above the law. This is why we've seen some of the executive orders challenged in the courts. President Obama's DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy, was in fact issued as a policy, a memorandum that was on DHS letterhead and signed by then Secretary of DHS Napolitano. And it, in my view, was a lawful exercise of prosecutorial discretion. It used the tool of deferred action, which has existed in our immigration system for years and with a strong legal foundation, to make the DACA policy available to people who came to the U.S. before the age of 16, were in school, and meet other requirements. It's true that some populations, including people who have DACA or DACA-like qualities, would have a better future with a durable solution like from Congress through the DREAM Act or a similar legislative remedy. But importantly, the need for discretion continues to increase when Congress fails to act. So no one should be surprised that there are a number of humanitarian cases worthy of discretion in the immigration system, especially where we don't have any kind of legislative response for years. Having said that, I don't consider it to be an either-or option. It's not an either discretion or legislation option. We'll always need discretion in the system. It is, think of it as a part of the human body. You need a heart for a functioning body. That, to me, is how discretion functions in the rule of law or in our system. Even with the DREAM Act, there might be people who don't qualify, but who may be eligible for this kind of humanitarian discretion.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Our church yesterday just had a sermon about newer immigration policies and how they're so horrible for many. I just wanted to tell about when I went to visited Ellis Island once upon a time. I was struck at a museum they had showing in what years people from what countries were admitted to the United States, and I, you know, whereas I was supposed to feel proud about my country, you know, my ancestors' countries being admitted, I felt terrible that it seemed kind of arbitrary that this year some people were admitted and other people weren't. But our country overall has had the distinction of accepting the most immigrants until very recently.
Joy, thanks a lot for the call. Shobha, what do you think?
That's a personal observation and one I would share. Certainly there is a history And that has included exclusion as well as welcoming. But if we care about a system that welcomes people, then we should be deeply concerned with immigration policies in the time of Trump, where the welcome mat is really a rug that's being pulled out for many people instead of compassion.
Thanks for the call, Joy. We'll go now to Steve with us in La Crosse. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate the discussion and the guest perspective. My question is, there was recently some money appropriated by Congress to improve conditions for people, refugee applicants held in detention. And I wondered if anybody is keeping track of if that money is actually going where it's supposed to and actually improving conditions for the people who are being held in those horrendous circumstances.
Steve, thanks for the call. Shoba, do we know if money from Congress is changing conditions in those facilities?
So I haven't tracked the appropriations history specifically. What I can say anecdotally is that conditions in detention, both for adults and children, as well as families, continue to be deeply concerning. I would also highlight that the choice to detain someone is just that. It's a choice. So the administration has discretion, for example, to not detain a child who is 8 years old and may have a greater well-being by being outside of detention and going to school.
Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. In our last minute or two, we talked some about what you're hoping to see from Congress, Shoba. When it comes to issues of discretion, what other kinds of changes or rethinkings are you hoping for?
Sure. So I think the executive branch or a future one has a lot of work to do. I want us to get back to a place where compassion and not cruelty is what informs how discretion is used. One former INS official I spoke to really put eloquently what the rule of law means. And he said that the rule of law has always meant rules plus fairness, you know, law and equity. So without equity or fairness, we don't have a rule of law. So that's how I frame and think about both equity and the rule of law as well. I think the White House should increase refugee numbers, narrow priorities. The courts have played a significant role. We haven't talked about courts. They've certainly provided short-term solutions, but the courts are not going to save us. And they certainly did not save us with the travel or Muslim ban, and more recently with the transit asylum rule.
As we wrap up, Shoba, is this something we're talking about enough right now? It flares up from time to time. Do you think it's enough of a focus, say, in the presidential race?
I'd like to hear more about immigration in the debates that I've been able to listen to so far, and in the way that we have this evening for candidates to really take a step back and connect the dots. Family separation is not just a story at the border, but also part of the consequence of the travel ban and the separation of fathers who are deported because of our haphazard enforcement policy. I want us to think about broadly about choice and discretion and the need to have fair discretion moving forward.
Shoba, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Shoba Sivaprasad Wadia with Penn State Law. She was with us today to talk about her new book, Banned: Immigration Enforcement in the Time of Trump. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an ambitious experiment brought together hundreds of Americans from across the political spectrum to try to have productive conversations about big issues. One of the organizers of America in One Room joins the show to share the results. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, mental health care providers and members of the clergy provide a lot of support for people dealing with mental health concerns. But who's taking care of them? A social worker tells us why we need to take care of the caregivers. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a local racial justice advocacy group about its new 12-step program that they say will help curb hate and violence. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.